From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been almost 2 months since the midterm elections took place. In the weeks leading up to them, Elizabeth Edwards, the wife of the 2004 vice presidential candidate John Edwards, was a guest on my show to share some of her thoughts on how the election might go. But the main reason she was here was to talk about how she survived through some very hard times over the years. 2 weeks before the 2004 presidential election, Elizabeth Edwards discovered a lump in her breast. Doctors diagnosed breast cancer on the same day that her husband and John Kerry conceded the election. But in her memoir, Saving Graces, Elizabeth Edwards says that learning she had cancer paled in comparison to learning that her 16-year-old son Wade had been killed in a freak car accident in 1996. Having breast cancer gave her a battle to fight, whereas there was nothing she could have done to save her son's life.
He died within seconds. There was an EMT in the car behind him, and he died by the time the EMT had gotten there, just seconds after the car had flipped. He was dead. So the very fact that we had something, that we had a chance to fight, really gave us a lot of hope. That's all we wanted, was a chance to make it right.
Did you ever learn how the accident happened?
It was actually a boy in the car with him, a boy who walked away. The wind had blown the car off the road. And he tried to get back on. It's an interstate highway, and the one wheel had gotten off. He tried to get on it. He couldn't at first, so he yanked the wheel probably too hard. It fishtailed and flipped. It was a freak accident that I suppose could have happened to anybody. He had a seatbelt on. He was driving the speed limit, but it was just one of those things.
The chapters in your book that deal with Wade's death and your grief are really beautiful and touching. Can you tell us a bit about him? What was he interested in? What kind of kid was he?
He was an unbelievably sweet child. I tell a story, I think, in the book about how he was a writer and he loved literature. I started him early because I love literature. I started him early reading, and first I could get him to read, Michael Crichton, things that were probably more little boy in terms of topics that he might be interested in, trying to fight the school system that was making him read Pearl Buck and The Good Earth. A sixth grade boy is just, that's just not what's going to happen for him. But he did learn to love literature and loved writing. He was studying as a junior in high school, as most kids do, American literature. The week before he died, they studied The Snows of Kilimanjaro with Ernest Hemingway. Well, the year previously, that was the spring of 1996, the spring of 1995, he and his father had climbed Mount Kilimanjaro together. So
it had a personal significance.
He had a personal significance to him, and he understood, instead of reading about the vistas, he had actually been there. And he sat in that class and never mentioned it. His English teacher found out when she read his obituary that he had climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. What that meant was that he was the kind of boy who never put himself forward, never said in any way, "I'm better, I have this or that that you don't have." In fact, he was very sensitive to the fact that he knew he had a lot of blessings.
Well, obviously, he had no plans for a political career if he never put himself forward. At the time of his death, you were 46. You had a teenage daughter, Kate. And then you and John began fertility treatments, and you gave birth to Emma Claire when you were 48 and Jack when you were 50. Did you have any concerns about having children so late in life?
Only the concern would be whether I was there for them as they grew older. And, you know, I'm blessed with good genes in terms of longevity. And at that point, I didn't have cancer, so I didn't have any threats of that. We're a very healthy family in general. So I thought, you know, I'll live into my 80s and 90s, as all my grandmothers have. And
but your husband was campaigning for the Senate. I mean, that would add a little burden to your life, wouldn't it?
Well, no, it certainly would, although I have to say that when you're having babies, it does spare you campaigning. You get to
happened to you a couple of times.
That's right. If you're nursing and having babies, then you don't have to campaign.
Well, there's been a lot of speculation linking fertility treatments and breast cancer. Were you aware that they might cause some risks to your health?
I had read that we've asked the doctors about it. They have no indication that this particular kind of breast cancer is related to the fertility treatments.
You've written that you already had a strong sense that you had breast cancer before the official diagnosis the day after Election Day. How frightened were you by the possibility of it?
I mean, it was frightening, but honestly, naive as it may sound, I was unbelievably optimistic that we would be able to beat whatever it was. I didn't have an appreciation that, in fact, I had stage 3 breast cancer, that this was, you know, really serious.
Well, the doctor told you that there was a 33% chance that the cancer had already metastasized to your liver.
Yes, that was actually probably the worst news, because when I think about breast cancer, honestly, and I'm glad we've gotten to this point, I now think breast cancer survivors is what I think. I think of the people who fought it and won, and how great it is we've come this far. When I think of liver cancer, I don't think of liver cancer survivors. We've come a good distance, but the prognosis is still not good.
And it might have spread to your bones as
right,
well.
Right, but it turns out that none of those things were true. It wasn't because of hoping. It just happened to be the case. And, of course, I kicked myself a lot for not getting the test that I needed to get that might have spared me even those fears.
You agreed to become part of a clinical trial as a way of dealing with the cancer. What are the advantages of participating in a clinical study? Isn't there a possibility you'll wind up getting the placebo?
Well, it is, although I was in a clinical study as opposed to a clinical trial of a new drug. I didn't have that risk associated with it, but I know that my treatment was as good as it was because there are women who took that chance before me. And I felt an obligation, honestly, to the women who are now my sisters in breast cancer who so bravely pursued these trials. And I felt an obligation to do my part for the next women down the road. Of course, for me, all it meant was additional testing, which is actually good for me.
Is that why you decided not to keep the illness private?
I didn't keep the illness private. One thing, I thought there was little chance I was going to be able to keep it private. I was going to lose my hair. But also because I had myself to blame, and I thought maybe if I spoke out that other people would get the mammograms. And in fact, I know because I received emails and faxes and cards that people did just that. One of the first emails I got was an email titled, "You May Have Saved My Life." Someone who got a mammogram found out that in fact she did have cancer.
My guest is Elizabeth Edwards. Her memoir, Saving Grace, is Finding Solace and Strength from Friends and Strangers, is published by Broadway Books. And you wound up getting an awful lot of emails, which suggests that you spent an awful lot of time at your computer.
I spent a lot. I've always spent a lot of time at the computer. Longtime user, and I think it's a great medium, very democratic medium. Everybody has access, basically the same access, which is great.
But 65,000 messages.
65,000 messages, email messages, is a lot. And then I received 30,000 cards, letters, packages, faxes. I mean, nearly 100,000 ways that people communicated with me, which was is overwhelming.
I didn't know there were that many Democrats in America.
You know, the truth is that I got a lot from Republicans who, I have to say, who always started their letter or their email with, "I am a Republican, but," and they were just as sweet as any letter I got from Democrats.
As you said earlier, sometimes having a child means you don't have to go on a campaign, and that's what happened with Emma Claire. Was that something you actually, obviously you didn't plan it,
but
were you at home saying, "Thank God I don't have to be out on the campaign trail"?
Well, I was hesitant. I mean, I love public policy, and I could talk about it for hours. On the other hand, this was an animal I knew nothing about. I mean, I watch C-SPAN and listen to everything that I can, but I'd never done it, and so I was hesitant to do it. It really helped, actually, once John had won, to go up to Washington, meet other wives, see that they, you know, did not all wear Supergirl uniform or outfits underneath their St. John suits, and that really I could probably handle this, and I handled it the way really that I wrote the book, and that is just to be candid with people, try to have as close to a real conversation with them as you can. And you're not going to convince everybody because not everybody agrees with you.
And you discovered that senators' wives are expected to have guarded conversations, to wear perfect clothes.
Yes.
So you were trying to break the mold a little bit by just being you?
Well, I couldn't. I don't think I can carry off somebody trying to be somebody else. And they may not have been being somebody else. That may be exactly who they were. I wasn't suggesting in any way that people were, it was theater for them. But it just wasn't me. I was more the person that you'd see at the soccer field, you know, slicing oranges during the middle of the game, or as I did in the Senate, wearing apparently very inappropriately to a work day, what I thought was a Senate wife's work day, wearing overalls and tennis shoes when everyone else was dressed in beautiful suits.
But you used to practice law.
I did.
This did require a certain amount of sacrifice on your part.
It did.
I mean, all the small talk, not only there, but when you're campaigning.
You
got to go a little brain dead, don't you? Or just make believe you are not 100% as intelligent as you are?
No, in the campaigning, honestly, I don't think there was any point at which I ever adopted any pretense. And it actually has made it a lot easier for me. I mean, I talked very frankly about things wherever I was. And I guess because most of the time I wasn't the person at the podium. I was the person in the audience. So I knew what I wanted. I wanted the straight story. I wanted somebody to, you know, if the other side is owed a compliment, just give the compliment. If you make a mistake, just say you were wrong.
But also during campaigns these days, you have to deal with a lot of negative campaigning, a lot of negative advertising. And I'm sure there were times when you saw ads that you felt misrepresented your husband.
You did, but that didn't bother me so much. I mean, the only question was, how do you clearly communicate what's wrong with that? Not having any personal response. That's maybe a protection that having lost a child gives you, is that that the rest of it seems pretty inconsequential, the nasty things people say. And hey, I said I use the internet a lot. If you want to find nasty things about yourself, there's a good place you can find them.
Well, if you want to find nasty things about politicians in general, just watch C-SPAN sometime. And one of the first things that John was asked to do when he joined the Senate was to be sworn in as a juror in Bill Clinton's impeachment trial.
One of the very first things.
That had to have been a shocking way to start the new job.
It was, but, you know, honestly, I think that the impeachment process was very bad for the country, but in some ways was very good for John, because it meant his initiation to this august body was through a procedure with which he felt unbelievably comfortable. And where you didn't usually have intimate contact with all of the other senators, it took you years to meet and do things with them. He was with them every single day, all of them every single day. That was, I think, a good thing for him. Allowed him to be more effective. He got to co-sponsor the Patients' Bill of Rights in his maybe his second or third year, which was an incredible experience for him. And it was because he had developed relationships and earned the trust of people that he might have not really worked with had it not been for the impeachment.
My guest is Elizabeth Edwards, who's a lawyer and has worked in the North Carolina Attorney General's office, also worked in the law firm of Merriman, Nichols, and Crampton in Raleigh, North Carolina. She's taught legal writing as an adjunct instructor at the law school at the University of North Carolina. And now she's written a book called Saving Graces, Finding Solace and Strength from Friends and Strangers, published by Broadway Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Elizabeth Edwards. She's written a memoir called Saving Graces. It's published by Broadway Books. Your first campaign speech for your husband's presidential or vice presidential bid, well, I guess president at that point. He was still running. He was running in the primaries. It was covered by the media at the home of some supporters in Concord, North Carolina, and you say it went terribly.
It was Concord, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
I was just awful. I had written out what I was going to say. Of course, I didn't want to read it, but I wanted the security blanket of it, so I'd written it out on a 3x5 card. And then spent the entire time with that 3x5 card wrapped around my finger, rubbing it over and over. I talked way too fast. I talk fast anyway, but I was speeding through it. And I think a lot of the candidates were doing fundraising at that point, and so there was not much for C-SPAN to cover on their road to the White House. So they picked on me on what I thought was unfair. I needed one under my belt before I had C-SPAN covering it, but I didn't get that.
And then you talked about Teletubbies off camera.
I did.
That's what people paid a lot of attention to.
Yes.
And that this was at a time when your husband was the outsider. Howard Dean from Vermont, John Kerry from Massachusetts were in
right.
their neighboring state. There was a press event the campaign had arranged for you at a diner in Claremont, New Hampshire, and one person showed up?
There were actually two, but the one never sat down. He just wanted to say hi on his way out. So when I got into the room, there was only one man there. Unfortunately, I had television and press reporters covering it as I had tried to have a conversation with just one man. It was hard. People didn't know who he was, and to get them to come listen to him was difficult enough. To get them to come listen to his wife was really a hard sell.
Well, how do you get through that? I guess you have to develop some kind of rapport with the people you're traveling with, the staff members and the reporters who are covering your campaign.
Yeah, you do. And I'm not entirely, I still, even after all this time, I'm not certain what a spouse can accomplish. I mean, I think that a spouse is a good window onto a candidate. On the other hand, you're not the candidate. And so you can talk about the policies and things, but you need to find a way, if you want to be effective, to reach people who are not just true believers and think it's a gesture of support for your husband or your wife to come out and listen. You have to find the people that you can actually convince, and I don't know that anybody's figured out how to use a spouse in that kind of an effective way.
And then if you don't do it, Howard Dean's wife decided to stay home and continue her medical practice because
right.
she felt that her patients needed her. She was criticized roundly.
Never by me, I'll say. I think that she had a perfect right to make that choice.
And if you had been in the middle of some legal battle back home,
you have an obligation to these people. That's your responsibility that you undertook, and you really wouldn't be a spouse you'd want to have, in this case in the White House, if you took those responsibilities lightly.
And then you say you and John found out that local debates were a waste of time.
Well, the debates were usually shown on cable television, and sometimes you were in places where not that many people got the cable television, so you weren't reaching as many people. And instead of debates are theater, and it's particularly when you have a large group of people, a large number of candidates, it's very hard to have an intelligent discussion about the issues. And so the candidates are all trying to find a way to communicate something that people will remember, which often becomes a one-liner. Also very hard to do when Al Sharpton is on the stage, to say something you think people are going to remember afterwards, because the likelihood is they're going to remember what Al said, not what John or Howard said.
So you got to come up with things that you know will be quotable.
Yeah.
And, but won't come back to haunt you later.
Right, absolutely. But that's not, you know, so that's not actually a meaningful way to communicate. So that's why I said it was a waste of time. I don't think it was helpful to the voters and in a good way, in a effective way, and it wasn't a good use of the candidates' time.
But then again, sometimes they work to your advantage. There was a debate that was sponsored by the Des Moines Register that not only gave John a chance to show his strengths and his personality, but also wound up gaining him his first major endorsement.
Right. That was a debate where John had been frustrated in the past by his efforts to try to jam in whatever one-liner he and his advisors had thought was going to be the thing people might remember. And he'd finally gotten to the point where he said, I'm just going to let people see something which is more abstract, and that is who I am. And that's at that point we felt like, you know, it was more effective. And you know, I hope that not just John, of course, learned the lesson of that. I know he did, but that all candidates do and realize that, you know, instead of trying to present a persona that you think or a line that you think is going to be effective, to be yourself, because honestly, the American people deserve to find out who these people are who suggest they might lead us.
During the campaign for the presidential nomination, then later for the vice presidency, you wound up in some places people might not associate with politicians on that level. A Goodwill store, later a Wendy's with John Kerry and his wife.
Yeah, the book tells us, I tried to sort of let people sort of peek behind the curtain to see what it was like to campaign. And, you know, there probably very few women who weren't about to go do something important and found that they just spilled something on their shirt. And that had happened to me in the middle of Iowa, where there were no stores on my way to the we were doing it at the Czech Museum, this event. I was joining John. So there was no place to stop. We passed a Goodwill, and I used to volunteer and put up books in Goodwill. I know they have clothes in Goodwill. So I said to stop and went in and bought myself a nice sweater set I still have today for $3.
Then you have a tradition of celebrating your wedding anniversaries at Wendy's?
Well, our first anniversary, and I think there's actually a picture of it in the book, that where we were moving. We were both incredibly grungy. My parents were helping us, and there was no chance we were going out to eat, even though in a fancy place, even though it was our first anniversary. So we just went to Wendy's. The next year, we had a new baby, and we were rushing around at something and found ourselves at Wendy's. And we thought, okay, that's 2 years in a row. So now it's been 29 years of Wendy's on our anniversary. I am hoping at some point we're going to have that really splendid anniversary dinner someplace really spectacular. But
for 30, I'm sure you can find a nice restaurant.
Maybe so. On the other hand, we probably have lunch at Wendy's then.
Well, the 27th took place while you were on the campaign trail, and you wound up celebrating it with the Kerrys, your children, and the people traveling with you. Had the Kerrys ever been to a Wendy's before?
None of the people had. I mean, Ben Affleck was with us, who grew up in Boston, working class neighborhood, but I guess there was no Wendy's right there and near him. So no one had been to a Wendy's before. So if you've ever been in line at a fast food place looking with people in front of you who've never seen the menu before, everything takes such a long time to get through it. And, of course, they didn't know what to expect from the process. They did order a backup lunch in case it was really dreadful, but I think they actually seemed to enjoy their lunch at Wendy's.
Did Teresa Kerry look to see if they had Heinz ketchup?
No, but she did say that the chili tasted good enough that it might have been made with Heinz products.
Elizabeth Edwards' memoir, Saving Graces, is published by Broadway Books. This is WNYC 93.9, AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Were you surprised when John Kerry asked John to be his vice presidential candidate?
I would have been surprised if he'd asked someone else, honestly.
Really?
Yeah.
You felt it was in the works?
No, I just thought it was so clear that John was both the counterbalance, that they both knew each other and had respect for one another. So I knew that they could work together. And John had been tested. I think that Dan Quayle came out to some criticism because he walked into a process with which he had no familiarity. You can't come from an Indiana Senate race, and the next thing you do is on such a huge stage. And so I think that battle tested, I think that Senator Kerry respected that John had been through it.
Well, there already were some problems with the Bush White House. There was dissatisfaction with the war already.
Right.
The economy was going through a rough time. There was the Social Security debate that had really wounded the Bush administration, and yet this ticket lost. Were you surprised?
I was always optimistic until the last, so I was surprised. I did not think that the American people would do this. I have to say, North Carolina, which is votes Republican in so many presidential races, although we obviously have elected Democratic senators and Democrats as governor, as we have right now. But people come up to me in North Carolina now and apologize for their vote. Because a lot of the things, so many of the things we talked about that might happen, so many of the things we feared, that apparently people did not, it wasn't just that they didn't believe John Kerry, they didn't believe me either when I said, that we're going to have veterans' health care is going to be a crisis, or that the Iraq situation, we're completely on the wrong course. And maybe it was national security. I don't know. Maybe it was a really effective turnout the vote, their process. That would be my guess, that they were unbelievably effective in turnout the vote.
Well, it is interesting that Al Gore lost Tennessee when he ran for president.
Right.
Perhaps south of the Mason-Dixon line, even the border states are now so solidly Republican when it comes to presidential elections that you really have to score hard.
I think that the problem with the South in the last election is that we didn't contest it. I mean, we did go to some of these states periodically. I went to Mississippi once. That's my mother's home state. I went to Mississippi one time. We weren't fighting Mississippi. We were in the book. I talk about it and how frustrating it was. We didn't fight in Louisiana. We didn't fight in Missouri.
Just conceded them.
We basically conceded. We did not fight in North Carolina. And you don't have any ads on TV. You're not trying to make the case to the voters. You shouldn't be surprised if they don't vote for you.
Many people assume that John Edwards will run for president in 2008, although he hasn't made any official announcement, has he?
No, he said very candidly that he's seriously considering it.
Do you think that his position against the war in Iraq will set him apart from Hillary Clinton, who's the other most frequently proposed candidate?
I think that his comfort with his position now is maybe what distinguishes him, is that he was willing to say something and that I think needed saying, which was that I was wrong, and that allows him to frame what we need to do in an honest way and direct way, and I think that distinguishes him from a lot of people, and I'm very proud of the candor.
But what do you think about the Democratic Party these days, considering all of the bad news that the Bush administration has been receiving recently? The Bob Woodward book is just the latest of many, and now there is this scandal with the Foley scandal. And yet I think no one is conceding these midterm elections to the Democrats. Well, why is that the case?
Well, it might be because, this 72-hour turnout the vote machine that the Republicans have developed, where we had more people voting in the last election. If John Kerry had gotten the number of votes he'd gotten in previous elections, he would have won. But the truth is that wasn't enough because they had this massive turnout the vote.
And Democrats can't do that?
Well, I don't think we're organized enough for it. Maybe we need to get to that point. Howard Dean, I hope, is working to bring the Democrats to that point. But honestly, we're not at that point yet. We do not. Maybe it's that we don't have the money for the Blackberries, or maybe it's something more simple that we just haven't. We have not put the effort into it that we need to.
Well, there was an article in the paper that said that the Republican secret weapon in this election is money.
Yes.
Elizabeth Edwards' memoir, Saving Graces, is published by Broadway Books. I want to thank you so much for being with us.
It was great to spend time with you, Leonard. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.